Coming up on Tech News Today, Bitcoin plummets. The tech execs give the president a little what for about surveillance. And how much would you pay for an LG Chrome OS all-in-one? All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, December 18th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT12. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zachter.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show that helps keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world and put them in some context for you, starting with the top 10 stories of the day in the news views. Apple confirmed the new Mac Pro goes on sale tomorrow, December 19th, starting at $3,000 US. The base model comes with a 3.7 gigahertz quad-core Xeon CPU with turbo boost speeds up to 3.9 gigahertz, 12 gigabytes of DRAM, two AMD Fire Pro D300 GPUs, and 256 gigabytes of a solid-state drive. You'll be able to order online through resellers or at the Apple Store.
Ruh-roh. China's largest Bitcoin exchange, BTC China, has stopped taking orders in Chinese currency because of regulatory pressure from the government, which has ordered businesses to stop accepting the virtual currency Bitcoin. It recently topped $1,000, which was definitely helped by demand from China. The move from BTC China sliced the price of the virtual currency in half. Big plummet. However, BTC China says it will continue taking deposits in other currencies.
Microsoft board member John Thompson says Microsoft should pick a new CEO early next year. Now, Thompson is leading the CEO search for Microsoft, and in a blog post says the company has identified over 100 possible candidates, talked with several dozen, then focused our energy intensely on a group of about 20 individuals. Microsoft's current CEO, Steve Ballmer, announced he was leaving the company way back in August.
Amazon announced it will bring its Amazon Web Service products to China. The service includes all your enterprise cloud favorites like EC2, S3, SQS, and all the other acronyms Amazon has been providing for a while. Amazon has actually been doing these kinds of services with Chinese companies like Xiaomi, but using local infrastructure will help improve its offering, as well as challenge Chinese company Alibaba for the title of Amazon of China, which Amazon would like to hold itself. A limited preview will begin in early 2014, and you can apply for access at amazonaws.cn.
U.S. President Barack Obama is meeting with a panel that he appointed to review government surveillance program privacy issues today. This is just days after the group submitted a report and recommendations on their findings. Obama said earlier this month in a TV interview that he would be proposing some self-restraint on the NSA in reforms the White House prepared to announce in January. A federal judge ruled on Monday that the U.S. government's gathering of American phone records is likely unlawful.
Google Glass got an update. First up is the ability to take pictures by winking. Google says it expects the winking action to go beyond pictures to allow other functions like paying a cab. Recorded videos are also easier to upload to YouTube with the command OK Glass, share with YouTube. Glass also gets full Hangout support and a new way to lock your glass with a set of taps and swipes.
The Sydney Morning Herald reports that the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission has ordered Apple to make modifications to its refund policy in order to comply with consumer protection legislation. Apple needs to provide adequate compensation to customers with faulty devices in the future, as well as re-examine any possible violations from the past 2 years and make good on those.
Chromebook is coming to desktops at CES. Wait, what? Yeah, LG has announced the Chrome Base, which is a 21.5-inch all-in-one computer running Chrome OS. Also has an Intel Celeron processor, 2 gigs of memory, and 16 gigs of solid-state storage with the monitor's 1080p IPS display. Well, maybe you'd like to use Chrome OS as a quick booting OS for simple tasks. This might be your next excellent solution.
Are you tired of scraping around for that laptop charger or like, oh, I left my laptop charger. Yours don't work. Yours won't. No, forget all that stuff. The International Electrotechnical Commission brings you hope with the announcement of Technical Specification 62700, which defines a standard for universal laptop chargers. The IEC standard for mobile phone chargers has been making progress. So the next frontier is the laptop charger. And IEC's General Secretary Franz Vrieswijk said a single power supply covering a wide range of notebook computers is the next step in lowering e-waste and its impact on our planet. The new specification for notebooks will be published in early 2014.
And combine that with flippable USBs, we've got an amazing future here. Delta CEO Richard Anderson, not to be confused with Richard Dean Anderson of MacGyver and Stargate fame, sent a company-wide memo saying Delta will not allow cellular or VoIP calls on any Delta flights. Anderson says Delta will move quickly to enable customers to use text, email, and other silent data transmission gate-to-gate. Another reason to fly Delta. I'm really glad I'm going tomorrow on Delta.
Delta gets you there.
Quietly.
That's all they promise. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace.com. It's the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. I've been using it to build a brand new website, and it's just amazing. It's impressive the way those new templates are. They've just added, within the past few months, 20 new beautiful templates for you to start with. All the style options you need to create a unique website for your business. If you're thinking, well, I need more than a blog, Tom, most of these just have the blog as an option. Most of them have these great looking front pages. You can have sticky posts. There's all kinds of options in there that you probably don't realize you have. And I just got an email from a guy yesterday who's like, you know what? I needed to make a website for our business and I'm the IT guy. I didn't have time to go. He's like, I could code this thing myself. I went to Squarespace and I did it that way. And I used the trial period and I gave it to my boss and the boss loved it so much. We used your code, got the discount, signed up for the service. You can do that too. It's easy to use. They have great support. It's mobile ready. So it looks good on all screen sizes. It's search engine optimized. So it ensures that your site's content can be crawled by all the search engines, not just Google, Yahoo, Bing, all the other search engines. And hosting is included. You don't have to mess with that. Squarespace takes care of the hosting, so you don't have to. Start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code TNT12 to get 10% off and to show your support for Tech News Today. We thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. Joining us now is everything we need to have a great discussion about tech news, Rafe Needleman from Evernote. Good to have you on the show, brother.
Good to see you. How you guys doing?
We're doing well. We've got some interesting stories, yes. And we start with Sarah Lane's favorite. Make it rain Bitcoins, Lane.
Yeah, well, there's fewer of them. At least they're worth less money now. And this happened overnight. So as I mentioned in the news views, we've got BTC China, which is China's largest Bitcoin exchange, saying, okay, we can't accept new yuan deposits, so in Chinese currency. The reason is not because BTC China doesn't want to be processing payments. It's because they use a third-party payment provider called YeePay, which told BTC it can't provide services any longer. The reason for that is because China's central bank has banned payment companies, not just YeePay, but payment companies, third-party payment companies, and gave them until the Chinese New Year, that's January 31st, to comply. Now, BTC can still process withdrawals, and in theory, BTC can still keep going on as usual, except that they no longer have a payment process in place, which makes it basically impossible to run as an exchange. Bobby Lee, who is BTC's chief executive, says this is government regulation. The central bank did warn earlier this month, Bitcoin is not legally protected. Financial institutions should not be using it. And because not completely driven by interest in China, but in a large part driven by interest of China, Bitcoin had risen exponentially. I mean, it hit over $1,000 last week, and it lost about 50% of its value overnight. And this is obviously in part largely because of what's going on in China. Bitcoin is still legal to use in China, so it's not illegal. But if you don't have payment providers, yeah, how do you purchase the currency? I mean, these exchanges exist for a reason. We know investors love Bitcoin, though. BTC China just raised $5 million in funding from Lightspeed, investor Lightspeed, We heard a few days ago Coinbase got $25 million from VC firm Andreessen Horowitz last week. So I guess what now? I mean, do exchanges have to process their own payments? Rafe, what do you think is the next step in this roller coaster?
Well, from my extensive work in postgraduate economic theory, I can tell you, Bitcoin is a new speculative currency. It is to be expected that governments will try to figure out how to get a handle on it, both to protect their own currency and or to protect their citizens from wild fluctuations and speculation and attempts at control of the market. I'm not at all surprised. It's going to be a rocky road to get Bitcoin or any new currency, any global non-governmental currency up and running. This has never happened before. So, you know, what do you expect? I can't imagine relying on Bitcoin right now. I can easily imagine investors putting money into it because it is such a big bet. This is the kind of thing that investors love. Chances for out-and-out success are not assured, but if they are, you've got a piece of the global economy. That's a kind of bet that that a VC is going to love.
I think you're absolutely right. From the wide view of this, you're going to see these kinds of fluctuations come and go, and they should, if Bitcoin is actually going to become a stable currency, they should get less over time. But yeah, when it shoots up to $1,000, it's going to fall down to $500 for whatever reason. That's going to happen again and again and again as we work the kinks out of using this currency. I think in China's case in particular, it's not surprising. In fact, it's very clever what China did here. They said, we're not going to ban Bitcoin. We're just going to tell the payment processors that they can't, or not even that they can't, that they really shouldn't be involved. And that means that even if BTC China wants to become a payment processor, they're going to have to figure out how to do it outside of China, or they're going to run afoul of the Chinese government. So they're putting the brakes on Bitcoin without causing an outright ban on it. That's what brought this current valuation down. But Bitcoin's still being used in all other places, all kinds of places. It's still even being used in China. So what this means is now China has a firmer control over their side of this equation. And the Bitcoins that flow through China will have to be bought and sold somewhere else. They'll just have to stay in the Bitcoin universe while you're inside the great firewall, so to speak.
It's interesting to see how China can kind of bat around the price of Bitcoin based on not necessarily banning it. They told the banks in China, don't treat this like currency. You can still mess with it, but it's not money. Don't think of it as money, allowing individuals to still do that. So it's a whole weird kind of idea there. But the idea about Bitcoin is if people can't accept, if they can't accept them or deposit them or use them, you can see the value dropping just really quickly, especially when it's one of the largest Bitcoin exchange in China. You could see just how volatile this is, but it's still growing pains. It's still early days for this currency. I think it's been around since 2009. So this is pretty impressive that it's still valued quite highly, but it still needs exchanges to survive.
Okay, let me just say, if you're China and there is a new global currency arising, if slowly, and it's interesting and perhaps a little scary and it could have an impact on you, and you put a ruling out this like this out there to drive down the value of the Bitcoin economy, what is your obvious next move? Buy Bitcoins and put them in your own
hoard
bank.
Them.
I'm just saying, this is the kind of thing. This isn't a currency. This is a speculative investment at this point. The fact that some people can use it as a currency to buy things, I think, is interesting. But this is still Hummel figurines that you put up on your shelf there. It's way too speculative to even be considered a currency, at least in my book.
Bit Hummels. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
We'll get to a few more side effects that Bitcoin is having outside of the currency market a little bit later. But let's talk about that meeting between the tech executives and President Obama in the United States. The president wanted to talk about healthcare and healthcare.gov when he called this meeting. It was meant to be him being seen consulting the tech experts of the industry. And instead, they decided to send a letter on December 9th about the surveillance going on. And that sounds like pretty much all they talked about. There were 15 executives in the room. They were at the Roosevelt Room at the White House. They warned the president surveillance relations were damaging their reputation, could harm the economy. They pressed for transparency and limits. Here's a few quotes from different sources. From people who were in the room or knew what happened in the room. Washington Post, according to one U.S. official, most companies pressed the point of transparency and limits and did so loudly. Another Washington Post quote here, the message was to say, according to one industry official familiar with the company's views, What the hell are you doing? Are you really hacking into the infrastructure of American companies overseas, the same American companies that cooperate with your lawful orders and spend a lot of money to comply with them to facilitate your intelligence collection? Imagine it was phrased a little differently actually in the room, but that was the sentiment. And Bloomberg reported that Marissa Mayer specifically warned President Obama the backlash over U.S. spying threatens to balkanize the internet as countries adopt different standards to thwart surveillance. That, according to another industry official. Of course, this is the way government news gets reported, off-the-record stuff from people who kind of knew what was going on. The White House said in a statement that President Obama made clear that we will consider their input as well as the input of other outside stakeholders as we finalize our review of Signals intelligence programs. And the rumors are that that review is not going to be as favorable as one might have thought when they first ordered the review to be done. All of that said, okay, the tech guys get in the room. They make their views known in no uncertain terms to the president. Rafe, does it do any good?
Well, we'll see. It has a potential to do good. The president's response to them was about as noncommittal as it could possibly be. But I think once it becomes clear that the commercial impact of businesses losing customers or losing deals because global customers don't want to rely on American technology that might have backdoors built into it or American services that might be being tapped, that could have a serious impact. That is giving our competitors, our global competitors, it's giving them business. And it's a difficult thing to balance, obviously, security versus business. But money talks. And over time, I think that the NSA has got to be reined in unless we want to continue to lose business to countries and businesses where the spying isn't as obvious.
Ayaz, what do you think? Is there any chance of an effect happening? You know, you had big wigs in this room. You had Eric Schmidt, who did a presentation. You had Marissa Mayer. You had Dick Costolo from Twitter. Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook.
Yeah, the first thing I started thinking of, like, who were the top contributors to Barack Obama's campaigns? And University of California is up there, Microsoft, and then Google. Tons of money there. So the first thing I think, oh, if he's up for re-election, yeah, that'd be an issue right away. Like, oh, yeah, knee-jerk kind of reaction. But obviously, that's not a possibility. But to have these companies that obviously have their own agendas, trying to make sure that their ideas are going through the U.S. Congress – these companies back a lot of politicians with lots of money. So while it might not have a direct impact right now or an immediate response by the president, I could see a lot of congresspeople being a bit nervous, saying, okay, if these backers aren't happy with us, well, this could influence their campaigns in the long run. So I don't know if this is going to make a huge change right now, but coming election season, it'll be like, oh, well, Google's backing this other person instead of their traditional candidates because they want to make sure that this kind of stuff doesn't happen. If you want users to trust you, and you have to be able to be everywhere, so they have to have a great public appearance as well.
The Consumer Electronics Show coming up January. We're starting to see the first pre-announcements from folks who want to stick a product in your mind before they show it off over in Las Vegas. And Ayaz, LG's got an interesting take on using Chrome.
Right. The Chrome base, as Sarah mentioned, is a 21.5-inch all-in-one PC, run the Chrome OS, 1080p screen. There's some details about this. It's got a Celeron processor, but it wasn't mentioned how fast it is. 2 gigs of RAM, 16 gigabyte SSD. No mention if the screen is a touchscreen. It comes with its own keyboard, mouse, speakers, webcam, and USB ports. Networking, 1 Ethernet port, speeds not specified. No Wi-Fi or Bluetooth mentioned, which seems a little strange for something like this. And the Chrome base also has an HDMI input. So if you wanted to use it as a monitor, you could still do that and maybe just turn it on for Chrome real fast or actually run a full operating system underneath that with another PC. Pricing and availability not announced, but you should be seeing this at CES next month. Rafe, what do you think the right price point is for an all-in-one like this? I mean, it's running Chrome OS, so that seems like it'd be really limited.
The right price point, well, it depends on who you're selling it to. If you're selling it to consumers, then cheap, you know, $200-$300. But then not having Wi-Fi will be a deal killer. I can't believe this machine will come out for any customer without Wi-Fi just because nobody wants to run Ethernet these days. If you're selling it as a kiosk, it's great, and you can sell it for a little bit more. Unclear from these stories if this is going to be sold to consumers. A Chrome-based machine actually makes a lot of sense, but consumers have shown that they're a little hesitant to rely on everything in the cloud on web apps, and there's still some things you can't do on web apps. So I don't know. I think for consumers, a Chrome-based machine has got to be portable. I can't imagine this being a big seller as a consumer product. As a kiosk product, though, it's great. I mean, you set it up in your florist or your Land's End showroom or whatever, and people can go online, or in the library they can use it. It's a great coffee shop machine for multiple users at the same time.
Something at, you know, like a public library or a place where there are a lot of people with varying degrees of computer proficiency, but really most people would just want to access a few things online and have a comfortable desktop experience, somewhere that you could put on a desk and be sitting there and it sort of seems normal. As long as it's priced really competitively, I think it's not an attractive product to me. And yeah, I mean, I'm at the point where I've got to have a computer that can fit in a backpack. But I think that there's a market for this.
I think probably my best guess, and I think Rafe identified the two main possibilities. My best guess is this is a Walmart-type device. This is maybe even a $99 desktop because you don't have Wi-Fi in there. So you've got to make up for that with some reason. And not having Wi-Fi to me means you're aiming at a market that is less technologically sophisticated. For the guy who's like, I just have a desk and my Ethernet cable from my modem, and that's all I need, right? And if it's $99, sold. People are going to jump on it. I think pretty much anything above $200, and this is a non-starter for sure.
Yeah, the Chromebox is an actual device right now that Google sells from Samsung. It's $329. This is aimed at consumers. That's a device that's actually for sale now. If you're going to have a 21.5-inch screen attached to that, seems like the price would be somewhere more like $400. If this was an awesome monitor, I could see this being an interesting way to get Chrome OS on a lot more devices, because I could see myself, instead of firing up my full machine, just going, I'll use Chrome OS as a quick, like, splash top kind of quick way to access the internet and do some basic tasks, but then fire up a real machine behind it. I think the idea of using it as a monitor might be the most intriguing to me, but if it's going to consumers, I don't think they're going to get it.
This is not a consumer product. I cannot see this possibly working. It's not portable. It doesn't have Wi-Fi. It's a kiosk thing, in which case I don't know why, in which case it needs to be hardened somehow so it doesn't get knocked over. I don't see consumers going for this product. Even if it has Wi-Fi, it's just the wrong form factor for people right now. Right now, the trend is towards everybody having their own device, generally a tablet. That's where people are going. That's the second screen. This is too small to be a TV monitor and too big to be a computer today, at least for individuals.
All right, let's move along to Tim Bucher's new company. He's a former Apple exec. Some of you may recognize his name. And they finally come above the water to announce something. What are they talking about?
Well, they're talking about a set-top box for the living room, but this one's different. GigaOm actually has a great write-up about a company. It's now called Live Minds. That's LYVE. It was formerly called Black Pearl Systems. And we heard about them first from GigaOm back in June, I think it was. They were in stealth mode. It was sort of like Apple executive, what's going on? They were hiring a bunch of developers from places like Netflix, Apple, Palm, TiVo, Amazon's very secretive Lab 126. So it's sort of like, okay, well, what's going on here? The first product is a device called Live Home, and we don't have any pictures of it. They say that they're going to unveil it at CES. So what we really know about it is really what Bucher has shared with GigaOm. He says it's small, there's a touch screen, and we'll see more about it later. What Live Home does, though, we do know, at least in part. It's supposed to back up, you're supposed to be able to, as a consumer, back up and access your personal media across a bunch of different devices through dedicated apps. Okay, well, that sounds like, iCloud or that sort of thing. But the mission is, they want to make it easier to be able to back up and store and share photos that people take on all sorts of devices. HD videos, for example. If you take enough of those, you have to start paying a Dropbox or an iCloud or a host of many other services, because that stuff takes up space. Bucher says most consumers just don't pay for cloud storage, so they don't really utilize cloud storage the way it could be utilized. Their apps, at Live Minds will let phones, tablets, computer talk to each other. Live will support iOS, Android, Windows, and macOS at launch, plans to add more platforms down the road, and the apps will back up photos from a mobile device to other devices in the network. They'll free up and reallocate space and keep multiple copies of each file. So it's sort of like a new file comes onto the scene, all your devices are talking to each other, and it's kind of replicating across these different devices and different OSs. It's also a little bit of a Sonos model, it sounds like. It's not the center of your network. It's just an addition to the architecture you already have in place. It copies and replicates videos and photos across devices. If you want another live home in your mix, you just sort of plug it in and you kind of add to your existing chain of devices. Again, we haven't seen what this looks like. We certainly haven't seen it in action. We only know that we've got some people who come from, you know, pretty solid pedigree putting together something that sounds pretty interesting. Rafe, what do you think? Cross-platform video photo sharing? I mean, you work in, you know, for a company that's all about being able to access, you know, media in different places. Right. What do you think about this?
Well, the need that people have to store and save securely their photos and their home videos is really critical. There is no good universal solution that works on all devices, mobile, desktop, whatever, and stores this stuff securely. But the market to do this is incredibly difficult. There was a great product out there until recently called Everpix, no relation, that did pretty much this with the cloud storage model. And they had high conversion. People who liked the service paid for it. They had growing user base. All the numbers looked good, but it did not succeed as an investment vehicle, and it went out of business. I think they're now trying to figure out what to do with the assets. So the challenge is getting users to come up to speed on this quickly enough and to show numbers that are so compelling that you can compete with Apple and other companies that are trying to be your hub for media as a third party. And that's incredibly difficult. I love this idea, no matter what the technology is, whether it's a mesh network or centralized cloud storage or whatever the heck it is, we are losing our memories because we're not organizing them well enough. And this type of product is needed. We'll see if this is the one that does it.
This reminds me of was like Microsoft Home Server. Do you remember that ill-fated product? And then there was
Have one.
Okay, so you know what it is then. It's this idea that you would have a server in your house and you'd be able to do the same kinds of things. Execution wasn't exactly there. The devices like this right now, like Pogo Plug, the transporter from Drobo, this idea where you have your own service in your own house, you're attaching your own hard drive to it so you have unlimited storage. And I think the thing about that, I've been using a Pogo Plug for like a couple of years now, and that kind of ease on your brain saying, okay, that file is already taken care of. I don't have to worry about incurring extra fees or I'll run out of space because I can always add another drive. I think that's very attractive. But the real thing is, how do you explain it to the masses that they basically have to be their own IT person when it comes to this? Because now you've got all kinds of issues going on with your router. Do you have to open up ports? Do you have to have an unsafe network? What exactly is this going to cause? What kind of issues would this cause for you as the administrator? Because this is, I think, pretty niche, but the thing is, how do you explain this to everybody? Yeah, it's easy and it's secure. It's kind of hard to have both.
Yeah, well, I think that's why Live Home is actually concentrating on making this just be photos and video sharing, right? They're like, we're going to run the software. We're not a network attached storage. That's a dirty word in our world. We're just helping you access your photos and you don't have to think about it. Whether you trust that or not, that's a very good question that Iaz is asking there. But I think that's the play that they're making is you don't have to be the network administrator. We'll take care of all that stuff for you. Now, that is a step down from trusting the cloud, right? Because at least you have something under your control. There are three very interesting articles out within the last couple of days about the fight for control on the internet. Drew Fitzgerald and Spencer Onti at Wall Street Journal wrote a great article, got a lot of buzz, documenting the struggle over buying up capacity as companies like Google and Facebook and Microsoft and Amazon are continuing to buy infrastructure. While the telecoms, who are known for building infrastructure, have sort of resisted investment because they don't want to squeeze their profit margins anymore. In this article, for example, Google controls 100,000 miles of fiber. Compare that to the U.S. company Sprint, which controls 40,000 miles of fiber. Facebook rolled out a massive high-capacity network in Europe and connected it to their Arctic data center in Sweden. Amazon's spending on infrastructure is up 44% to $2.6 billion as it buys up fiber networks. Microsoft building its own network and investing in underwater cables. Joshua Kopstein, then, in a separate article in The New Yorker, describes the reaction to this sort of centralization among a bunch of companies, saying there's a lot of projects out there trying to get you control of the internet back. ArcOS from Jacob Cook. They're going to be talking to ArcOS folks on Floss Weekly starting in January. You might want to check that out. The personal cloud on a Raspberry Pi device is what that is. So that's the one I was talking about, where you really do need to be your own system administrator and your own tech support. Brennan Novak's MailPile, a better way to do secure email on your own. There's things like BitMessage and Namecoin, which I alluded to earlier, trying to take the system that Bitcoin uses for security and peer-to-peer and apply it to messaging and domain namespace. There's been less successful efforts too. Diaspora was an effort to open source a short messaging service like Twitter. It hasn't really taken off. There was Eben Moglen's Freedom Box, which has yet to launch. And then finally, Stacey Higginbotham of GigaOhm was at the Fiber to the Home conference in Austin, and she reports that the big talk there was about software-defined networking, allowing providers to build out channels. So those telecoms that don't want to invest in the infrastructure, they're trying to find ways to monetize gigabit. So when they do roll it out, they can charge you virtually based on the service you're buying. Joe Kokin of US Ignite, a group trying to develop gigabit applications, proposed a pricing model where users buy access to a set of capabilities for either an application or a genre of application. Now, he used medical, like you buy the medical service, and then the medical stuff is, I don't know if prioritized is the right word, but that's what it sounds like to me, and delivered to you over gigabit, so that your internet becomes more like bundling of cable. Rafe, given these different visions that we're laying out here, what's your best guess on what the internet looks like in 5 years?
Boy, I hope that what you just described does not come to pass, because, you know, this is what we were arguing about 2 years ago about was it conditional access, what'd you call it, where, you know, there were these ideas that you would have to pay more for bits from Netflix versus from YouTube if you happen to be a Google customer, and scary stuff like that. I'm not surprised to see the big internet companies investing in their own infrastructure. If it is such an expensive thing, the last thing you want to do is rely on a telco, which may not be investing in this. They could either hurt your service or jack up your rates. It makes more sense for you to own the pipes. But what you're describing in terms of, you know, decentralized or a mesh network or mesh services, I mean, I can imagine some of this happening in the next couple of years for the geeks among us, using distributed mail services or distributed websites or stuff like that. But consumers want simplicity. They want to pay a company for the pipes coming into their house, and they want everything to come through the pipes without discrimination. And companies like Google or Amazon or your telco are going to be the ones, as far as I know, who are going to be able to provide that, because they can afford the infrastructure. Building a mesh service is cool. It can be more secure. It can be more robust. But it is very difficult technologically to build a service like that that is reliable and as pervasive as people want it to be.
All right, let's finish off with something a little more hopeful than the idea that none of us are actually going to control the internet possibly in the future. And that's Avogant Glyph, a virtual reality headset. What sets this one apart, Ayaz?
Okay, so this one's a little different because they're using a technology called virtual retinal display. Now, let me tell you about the device a little bit. It looks like a pair of headphones, but the band on the top that you normally would have to connect the speakers actually can flip down over your eyes. Okay, so here's how this works. The Avogant Glyph would actually project images onto your eyes. And talking to The Verge's David Pierce, here's how Avogant's CEO explained how exactly this works.
When we look around the room, my eyes don't get tired, right? I don't have any problem seeing 3D, and I don't get nauseous or seeing headaches. I get headaches when I'm looking around the normal world. And so, you know, we try to recreate that light as closely as possible so we can separate where the light is generated from where the light is modulated. And how we modulate light means we have these mirrors that bend and twist, and all we do is pick and choose what colors of light are bounced in and what colors of light are bounced away. It's a micromechanical part that's machined using kind of semiconductor-type processes. So you have these millions of tiny mirrors that are hinged, and they're just wobbling at an insane speed.
And so the idea is that you're going to be perceiving video and other content in a way that's much more like you do in real life. The prototype version of the Glyph is about the size of an Oculus Rift. They're trying to get it smaller. The Verge says there was no eye strain when using the device. You have to tune it for your actual eyes, though, so there's no weird double imaging. And the Glyph doesn't take over your entire field of vision. It fills about 45 degrees with the picture. You could look down. You could see a keyboard. You could still look around to see the world around you. The Glyph's coming in 2014. There's a Kickstarter campaign coming on January 22nd. And it's going to cost about $500. That's the goal. Rafe, do you think this kind of form factor, I mean, there's a lot of talk about wearables. Do you think that Glyph has a chance considering this form factor?
Well, not the way it looks right now, but, you know, the technology, the idea of the retinal projection technology is really, really cool. I saw a prototype of a device like that that was very much like Google Glass in that it showed, it displayed an image into your eyes, but the hardware that you saw in front of your eyes was this big, but the image was like this big. And it was the right technology for Google Glass, but the software was all wrong. This thing looks like it's a new technology for getting information into your eyeballs, into your brain, and we'll see about the software. You marry this with Oculus Rift. Actually, this looks really different from Oculus Rift because Oculus Rift takes up your entire field of view. It's the holodeck. It's totally immersive. This looks like a heads-up display, although, like I said, not with those big wonky things in front of your face. If they can get the thing down to a little sliver that you can mount on your eyeglasses, yeah. I mean, this is where we're going, right? We're going to have devices that we wear on our heads that project images into our eyes. The hardware is not there yet. Give it a couple of years, maybe only a couple, and it will be, and then hopefully the software will catch up. I love this. I love the idea of using some optomechanical device to put information into our head. I just hope they don't hack our brains in the process and blow them up. But, man, this thing looks so cool. I can't wait to try it.
I agree. I think it's, you know, it's a little bulky right now. It's, you know, if you compare it to something like Google Glass, you say, well, Google Glass, you know, it's, whether or not you think the glasses look dorky, they're easy to wear. You walk around. They're not really intrusive. But at the same time, there are a lot of people saying, well, you know, you don't have Google Glasses. It's before its time. Something like Glyph almost makes more sense. And since it's not so immersive, you could technically be multitasking and doing other stuff at the same time while you're sitting at your computer, getting some information into your eye without making your eyes tired. Not having used it before, I love this idea.
I think the coolest thing about this to me is the fact that they allow your field of vision to be split. And I'm a little skeptical how that's going to work in practice when I want my field of vision to be full for, say, a video game or something. But the fact that I can look down, I'm not wrapped around like the Oculus Rift with a hood, that means I can't do anything else, does open it up to other non-video games. So maybe this isn't meant for the video game type of thing, the immersive type of thing. It can be meant for all kinds of other cool things. I don't know what those are yet, but I love the idea of saying, hey, if this was your objection on Google Glass and this was your objection on Oculus Rift, you know, we have a place in the middle for you to try something out.
Yeah, The Verge tried it out, and it was actually connected to, a PS3, and it mapped the glasses to the right analog button. So as David was turning his head around, apparently the camera would move that way. So it could work with video games that way. It's just, I would imagine that you could still see things from the left to right that's going on there. I'm intrigued with the idea of no eye strain, because a lot of these devices, I mean, if you're looking at an iPad long enough, your eyes will get tired. If you're looking at pretty much anything that's glowing at you, that's an issue. But to have a device that you would be wearing, I wouldn't say all the time, because this does look pretty bulky. It looks like if you just take the band down from your big headphones and see, it's going to look kind of silly, kind of Cyclops-like, the X-Men, not the Odyssey character. But I'm really intrigued by this. I want this to succeed. I just think it's this little transformer kind of device. Bring it down when you want it to be goggles. Put it up when you want headphones. That might be the way to wear it, because I already wear headphones. Why not this?
Let's fire up the randomizer, Jason.
I'm on the clip. There we go.
Randomizer. 61% of the live audience in our straw poll voted for woman falls into bay while browsing Facebook. Thanks to PCGuy8088, who submitted this on our subreddit, and Chris Matistic over at CNET wrote it up. At least that's the link we saw. She was walking along the pier in Melbourne, and someone saw her just fall into the water. And apparently it's because she was checking her Facebook timeline. Not the first time something like this has happened. Does it still entertain you guys?
Well, don't they? I heard a story, probably apocryphal, that in Japan they have to pad the light posts with like gym mat materials, so girls who are doing texting on their phones don't bonk into them when they're trying to walk down the street. Fences, hey, they do work.
The best thing about this is that she didn't damage her phone, Sarah.
Well, sure. I think stories like this are fine and good when you're like, ha ha. She got wet and her phone didn't die, but then you put somebody in a car and it's like, this is like distracted behavior that in general it can end very, very badly. So I think it's a warning that whatever laughter you may take away from this story, it's that you are distracted and bad things will happen to you.
I mean, this could have been an interesting story as well, because apparently she couldn't swim, but she floated on her back. If her phone's still working, she should be looking up like a YouTube tutorial of how to swim. How to get out of this.
So it might have been. They might have fished her out before she finished it, though. You know, sometimes they're a little long.
No, it's just a shame.
All right, let's check the calendar. What's going on there?
Well, all we've got, really, is that Winamp is going to be discontinued on is it tomorrow or Friday? Gosh, I keep thinking today is Thursday. I'm very confused with myself. It is Friday. So we're looking ahead 2 days. You guys have a couple days to put together your eulogies, your yes. llama jokes, your whatever you need to do. That's what's happening. It's a pretty slow week leading up to Christmas.
Yep. Last chance to whip any llamas that you want. I bet we got some emails, don't we?
Incoming message.
I bet you're right. We got a message from Alan. Besides impulse convenience purchases, I think there are two additional reasons to use Amazon's GoPago service, a GoPago-based payment service. There are products I don't buy on Amazon because I'm not confident they will survive shipping or even the warehouse packaging process. The other reason is that I may trust my local retailer to provide a quality product, whereas products ordered from Amazon sometimes vary in quality. Interesting approach. Yeah.
Those are all good reasons to shop locally, whether they do, you know, GoPago or not. But that would give Amazon a chance to get those dollars as well. That's what Amazon wants, all the dollars.
All right, another email comes from Brian in Atlanta. He says, according to an article that he shared from Engadget about Facebook autoplay ads, he says, Facebook video ads on mobile will pre-download via Wi-Fi, so they shouldn't affect your mobile data plans unless you're going through a MiFi or some other mobile hotspot. That doesn't eliminate the desire for an opt-out option, though.
Good to know. Thank you, Brian. Helping us figure all
this out. Yeah, I don't think Facebook would be able to get away with it otherwise.
Yeah, they would have a backlash. Well, they're going to have a backlash anyway. They'd have an even worse backlash.
Right.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Rafe Needleman, for joining us today. Always a pleasure. You can't talk about what you're up to.
I'm at Evernote, and I'm working on something that's unbelievably cool, and I wish I could tell you about it, but I cannot. But I can tell you about... What?
Does it involve the moon? Are you going to the moon? Is Evernote going to be in the moon?
I can't confirm or deny that we have a secret moon base. But I can tell you that if you are still worrying about Christmas presents, then go to the Evernote market, evernote.com/market. And we've got some really cool stuff. It's really neat, especially the scanner, which is unbelievably awesome. And I say that as a product reviewer, the Evernote scanner is expensive, but man, is it cool. Very handy.
Check him out, evernote.com. And of course, I'm not suggesting that you pester Rafe to reveal his secrets, but you can follow him on Twitter at Rafe.
Please do. Yeah.
R-A-F-E. Please follow him. Don't pester him, though. That's it for this episode of Tech News Today. Don't forget, you have a voice in what stories we cover at technewstoday.reddit.com. You can email us, tnt@twit.tv. Give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. And of course, visit our website for all our show note links and podcast subscription links at twit.tv/TNT. We'll be back tomorrow with Nate Langson from wired.co.uk as our guest. See you then.